Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about politics and current events in Bangladesh. On the 11th of January, the president of the country declared a state of emergency, and he canceled elections that were due to take place on January 22nd. The emergency declaration followed weeks of violence between supporters of the country's two main political parties. This long-standing rivalry, many people feel, has made it almost impossible for government to make much progress on dealing with some of the country's major sorts of problems. And many people worry that radical Islamist parties will benefit. This morning, we'll be talking about, current events in Bangladesh with Ali Riaz. He's a professor in the Department of Politics and Government at Illinois State University and has been since 2002. He also has been assistant professor and lecturer at the University of Dhaka in Bangladesh. He's also has experience as a journalist. He's worked for the BBC World Service for 5 years as a producer and senior broadcast journalist. He is here visiting the campus. His visit is sponsored by the folks at the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security, as well as the program in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. And he'll be talking about politics in Bangladesh this afternoon at 3:30 in room 356 of the Armory Building on the campus. And I'm sure anyone interested in attending and hearing more from him should feel welcome. Also this morning on this program, questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest, Dr. Riaz, has written 4 books in English, more than a dozen in Bengali, and one that I'd just like to mention because it bears on the topic that we're talking about here this morning is a book titled God Willing, The Politics of Islamism in Bangladesh. Roman and Littlefield is the publisher. It's a paperback, and I'm sure that can be found in a bookstore near you or in the library if you're interested in reading the book. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
To begin, I think it probably as a way of providing some background to what is happening in Bangladesh now, it would be good for people to hear just very briefly an account of how it is Bangladesh came to be. Has only been Bangladesh has existed as Bangladesh only since 1971. And I think that probably the events surrounding the creation of the country as we know it today are connected with the political unrest that is going on now. Now, I realize probably we could talk for a long time simply about the creation of Bangladesh and its early history. But for people who have no background at all, what's the most basic things that people should know?
You see, Bangladeshis love talking about history, and sometimes they distort the history as well. So here's my take. Bangladesh became, as an independent country, it came in 1971, as you mentioned. It was previously part of Pakistan. Pakistan was created in 1947. Until 1971, it was called the East Pakistan. And at that point, the major issue was that the Bengalis, the ethnic Bengalis who constitute the majority in used to constitute majority in Pakistan until 1971. They felt that they have been marginalized and they have been deprived of their rights, basically the democratic rights. In terms of resources, they were not given the ones that they thought or actually truly they deserved. And politically, they were marginalized in the sense that they never, despite the fact that they were the majority, the Bengalis never had the opportunity to rule Pakistan. And the only election in case of Pakistan, Pakistan itself went under military rule from 1958 to 1969, then again in 1969. In 1970, there was a parliamentary election, and the majority party, or the party which emerged as the majority party, was the Awami League, led by Sheikh Mujibur Rahman. And he was a Bengali, and the Bengalis actually emerged as a majority political party. But the Pakistanis, especially the ruling elites of Pakistan, decided not to hand over the power. And that led to a massive genocidal war that began on March 25th, 1971. And the Bengali leadership at that point, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, declared independence and they formed a government in exile. India came to aid the rebels or the freedom fighters, and for 9 months there was war. And at the end of the war in December 16th, 1971, the Pakistani forces, 90,000 of them actually, they surrendered to the joint forces of the freedom fighters of Bangladesh and India. In the meantime, actually, about 10 million people fled Bangladesh. They became refugees. India provided them shelter. And millions, if at least, you know, according to one account, 3 million people died. They were killed by Pakistanis. So in short, that is how the Bangladesh came into being, you know, in 1971. And since then, Bangladesh has continued as an independent country.
Yeah. Just even to take a, not to, to talk about this too much more, but just to take an even greater step back, I'm sure that there would be people who would wonder how it is that at the time of partition in 47, one ended up with two Pakistans, east and west. They were 1,000 miles apart. Why did that even happen? How did that even happen?
David, that happened because the Pakistan at that point was created on the basis of religion. Right. Mostly it was the Muslim majority areas that constitute Pakistan, and which later became Bangladesh, was largely Muslim. So they voted in favor of joining the Pakistan. That is how, despite the geographical, you know, difference, it's 1,000 miles apart, mm-hmm. two wings, and practically, other than that religion, there's nothing common between the eastern part of Pakistan and the western part of Pakistan. Western part itself has its own diversity, and the part that became East Pakistan, it is, one thing was interesting is that that was homogeneous. One language, mostly one language, Bengali, ethnically mostly Bengalis, almost 88%, though they were Muslim, but for them at that point, their Muslim identity actually was far more important than their ethnic identity, which is the Bengalis. But soon after 1947, soon after Pakistan became independent or Pakistan was established, the Bengalis insisted on their ethnic identities because that is what they are. They have been for a long time. So the ethnic identities became much more pronounced, much more important for them. Mm-hmm.
So here we have two countries that, in a sense, two countries, the East and West Pakistan, created as a result of the partition to be countries for Muslims. And that was really the only thing that they had in common. So here we have the people in East Pakistan, actually a coherent group, culturally different in language, the Bengalis, different from the people in Pakistan. So there was this very strong drive for it to become an independent country, which eventually happens in 1971, becomes Bangladesh. Now, though, it seems that now, though, for those 35 years since that, there has not been much stability in Bangladesh, and it would seem that for a country that seemed to have a lot of coherence, that there has been an awful lot of political unrest and instability. There have been a number of military coups. There have been a lot of changes of government, and here now today, we have a very bitter, divisive strife between the two main political parties, which, as I read it, have their agendas are essentially the same. You can't say that they're divided because they have different political agendas.
Very little difference, politically speaking. Yes.
So how is one to understand then the fact that since 1971, virtually since Bangladesh was created, there has been so much churning and instability in the country's politics, and people haven't managed to get together and say, well, essentially we're really one people. Let's all get together and work on and bettering the country.
That didn't happen because 1971, when Bangladesh became independent, largely there are two elements of the Bangladesh movement. Mm-hmm. One is the secular element of it. that basically what the Bengalis, ethnic Bengalis, were saying, that yes, we are Muslim, but that's our private life. Insofar as politics is concerned, we want to have a secular country. And Bangladesh, if you look at the first constitution as it was written, even if you go back into the whole movement, the Bengali nationalist movement in 1960s, the fundamental point was that the separation between religion and politics. The Pakistan was established based on religion, and what the Bengali ethnic nationalist movement was that we want that separation. And that is what led to Bangladesh movement, the establishment of Bangladesh movement. And in 1972, the first constitution as it was written actually clearly articulated that one. But that changed in 1975. Bangladesh first encountered its military coup in 1975, and the founding leaders, including Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, was assassinated, killed. And that is where the division actually started. Yes, there were misrule between 1972 and 1975. Yes, there were authoritarian tendencies of the populist regime. And that is, in a sense, nothing unusual. In 1970s, if you look at the whole South Asia, Pakistan had Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, India had Indira Gandhi, and Bangladesh had Sheikh Mujibur Rahman. All of them are very populist authoritarian regimes. That happened in the whole South Asia. So I'm not exonerating the Awami League regime, but what I'm saying that there has been some tendency. But the situation changed dramatically in 1975 when the founding leaders were killed and military came into power. They faced a crisis of serious legitimacy. Why? Why they have taken over? And they wanted to establish this, wanted to create an ideological hegemony, some sort of a, you know, reason that they have taken over. That is the time when we saw the introduction of religion into the politics. And the division actually started there. When they say that, okay, religion is becoming a part of our politics, that is where we see the division. Now the division that we are seeing between, say, for example, Bangladesh Nationalist Party, BNP, mm-hmm. and the Awami League, yes, the Awami League has moved away, quite away from that secularist ideals. But generally speaking, the split is here between the secularist and those people who believe that religion should be part of politics. Though there are very little difference in terms of economic policies, little difference on many issues. But there's a fundamental somewhere beneath all these, you can see there is a difference in relation to or in regard to the role of religion in public life. And that is where we see these differences. That is where we see that there are two visions here. And one is basically to create a secular Bangladesh. The other one is mostly to emphasize the Muslim identity, that yes, we are Muslim first and Bangladeshi. And, you know, this difference, this is the major difference that we can see, and that is the contestation. And the instability that we are seeing, say, for example, between 1975 and 1990, Bangladesh actually was under military rule for 15 years. You know, yes, there was a few civilian, you know, pseudo-civilian regime, but essentially it was military rule. Since 1990, I would say 1991, beginning 1991, Bangladesh has entered into a democratic era. And over the last 15 years, despite limitations, and of course there are shortcomings, and it is, I will say, the growing pains of democracy, two political parties and others have participated in a process that tried to establish the democratic institutions.
Yeah. Let me very quickly introduce again our guest for anyone who might have tuned in. We're speaking this morning with Ali Riaz. He is Associate Professor in the Department of Politics and Government at Illinois State University. And we're talking about the politics of Bangladesh, something that he has followed and studied and written about for some time. He's here visiting the campus to give a talk this afternoon at 3:30. Anybody who is interested is certainly welcome. Of course, questions here are welcome too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'd like to talk a little bit more and have you talk a little bit more about these two parties, the Nationalist Party, the Bangladesh Nationalist Party, and the Awami League, and its leaders, because certainly in a lot of the stories that I have read here about what has gone on, at least for the last couple of months, going back to the point where the caretaker government takes over in the run-up to the elections that were supposed to have happened a week ago. As you say, there was this period of military rule that ended in 1991, in large part, because of a cooperative effort between the BNP and the Awami League, got rid of the military government. And then for a period between 1991 and 2006, the two parties and their leaders took turns leading the country. Mm-hmm. In 2001, it was the BNP, and they had the government from 91 to 96. And then from 96 to 2001, it was the Awami League. And then from 2001 to 2006, it was the BNP once again. And what happened in October was, according to a provision in the Constitution that is supposed to keep, I guess the idea is supposed to keep the party in power from interfering in the election. There's this requirement that says 90 days before the election, power must be given over to a caretaker government. And then within 90 days, the election is supposed to happen. And that's when when the caretaker government takes over, that's when things seem to start to go wrong. And particularly it seemed that the Awami League they had a number of complaints. They felt that the election commission was biased, that the country's president who was sworn in to lead the government was biased, the BNP had swelled the country's voter list with all kinds of people that didn't exist, the Awami League and some other parties had said, until we can take care of this, we're not going to have anything to do with this election. So having said all that, in many of the stories that I read, though, it makes it sound as if really the country's biggest problem is the rivalry between the BNP and the Awami League and the two leaders who, interestingly enough, are both women, one the daughter of the first president and the other the husband of a general who was the second president, both of them who were assassinated. And it makes it sound as if this is really much it's a personal rivalry between these two women and then between their parties.
It is in part. I would, in some ways, you know, it's partly... It's a personal rivalry between two leaders, Sheikh Hasina, who is leading the Awami League. Awami League is a party which has been there for more than 50 years. It led the nationalist movement in Bengali nationalist movement. Mm-hmm. And the other party, Bangladesh Nationalist Party, led by Khaleda Zia, her husband, Sheikh Ziaur Rahman, was assassinated in 1981. In some ways, yes, there is a personal rivalry, but I think it is more than that. And sometimes we miss that point. It is basically an issue of political culture. These two political parties, and here when I'm saying these two political parties, I'm not trying to say that there isn't any other political party. There are other political parties, but given that these are the two major political parties, both of them, in some ways, behave in a very undemocratic way. There is a lack of internal democracy in the parties. And basically, these two political leaders actually came to politics because of their family connections. Yes, they have grown and they have, in some ways, learned a lot. But nevertheless, the party structures have remained the same. And the party structures are not very democratic. The political culture that I'm referring to is always a zero-sum game. If you get it, I'm not getting anything. The culture of compromise, culture of understanding. Because if you look at the last three elections, these two political parties get around 40% of popular vote. So practically, they are pretty much equal in terms of their support. And you simply cannot, you know, say that they don't exist. But that is the attitude that I have seen within both political parties, as if they simply want to annihilate the other party. They don't want to recognize the existence of the other political party. And the problem lies there. And this political culture of intolerance is the major issue. That's why when people say that it's a rivalry between two political leaders, yes, I say it is part. The other thing is the institutions. What happened in the last 15 years? Bangladesh politics, what we have seen is in some ways failed to create the democratic institutions. The democracy that we have seen in Bangladesh for the last 15 years is basically the formal part of democracy, not the substantive part of it. How do you make people participate? It is not only election. Yes, we can have election every 5 years, but that is not going to ensure the participation. Bangladeshi people, generally speaking, the citizens of Bangladesh are very political. As I say, they love history, they love politics. And if you see, they will keep on talking about politics. But the institution has not been created to accommodate all these aspirations. And the democratic institution, it takes time, but it also takes patience, cooperation, and obviously, and of course, what is needed is to work together. That is what is missing. Mm. So whether this is, and when you mention these are two women, sometimes I feel that there is a gender issue there. I mean, had this been two men, we wouldn't have said that these two men, So that is an issue that actually is there. So I want to see it beyond these two individuals, actually.
Just very quickly, and I have a caller here when we get to you in just a moment, but I think some people, you know, some people might say, well, this orderly transition from one government to another that we've seen over the last 15 years should count for something, and I think that in fact, when Khalida Zia served out her term from 91 to 96, I think that was she was the first prime minister ever actually to complete a 5-year term. Is that not exactly
because in 91-96, even before she completed her term, she had to resign under popular movement. That was the Awami League's movement. That I don't know whether it was necessary. I say that it was not necessary. 1996, especially late 1995, when she was pushed out of power, despite the fact that there was some legitimate concern. But I think that when someone is elected to power, they should be allowed to serve their term, which Sheikh Hasina did. And BNP, yes, they created major problems and all sorts of things, but Sheikh Hasina's term, 1991-96, of course, was the first term when we saw that a government has completed its term. This time, Khalida Zia, between 2001 and 2006, she completed her term. And I think that that's necessary for healthy democracy to continue and build the democratic institution. It is necessary that the party in power completes its terms.
I guess I'm interested in whether you think the kind of complaints now that seem to have thrown things all off the tracks last fall, the complaints of the Awami League about the bias of the Election Commission and the problem with ghost voters on the voter rolls. Do you think that those complaints were justified?
Yes, I think that they were justified. The whole issue, the problem, in some ways, some of the demands made by Awami League, for example, when they said that they were objecting to the past Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to take over, that I don't agree with them. I thought that they should have allowed the immediate past Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to take over as the head of the caretaker government. That they shouldn't have done. However, the other complaints that they made, for example, the bias of the election, it was obvious. The people, if we look at the profile, if we look at the people who have been appointed there, they were partisan, blatant partisan. The voters list, you know, the whole voter, the electoral roll was full with errors, you know. And NDI, for example, when they checked the whole thing and they came up with a figure about 11 million voters were not exactly the truly should have been there. Well, not necessarily someone deliberately put those things. Some of them were mistakes. Some of them were deliberate. In some cases, people moved and there are a lot of problems. But most of these claims that were made or the demands made by Awami League at that point, were justified, because it was obvious that that is what was going on. And this is the development of 2005 and 2006 that led to this kind of situation that we are now experiencing.
So now the what was supposed to happen is that once the caretaker government takes over, within 90 days, there's supposed to be an election. So we've now passed that point. The state of emergency declared. Another guy comes in to head up the caretaker government. He declares state of emergency, postpones the election. So what do you think is going to happen now here in the near term?
There will be an election. At least I hope so. I mean, there is a necessity. I mean, at this point, yes, this is a military-backed and international community-supported technocratic government. And this will continue for a short period, I hope, for a short period. And there will be an election. But before that, there are a few things that this government needs to do. They will have to do it for the sake of democracy. And this is where it is interesting that the crisis has reached to a proportion, has reached to a level where someone who is not elected is stepping in to continue and strengthen democracy. I mean, it is supported by military, and the Bangladesh military, its previous, you know, experience with power is not very good, at least between 1975 and 1990. But now they're acting in a fashion. In 1990, late 1990, they did well. I mean, they didn't take over the government. And also this time, I mean, they were reluctantly, as far as I know, they took over, or at least they did what they did reluctantly. They were not very interested in getting embroiled in the politics. You know. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that there will be an election, but before that, there are a few things that needs to be done to make sure that there is a fair election. There is a level playing field. For example, you know, we talked about the voters list. That needs to be fixed. Mm-hmm. Election Commission, which is practically has become, it is not only controversial, it doesn't have any respect from the voters. I'm not talking about the individuals. Maybe they're good, maybe they're not. That's not my issue. For me, in order to have a fair election, the Election Commission must command respect, and people should think that they are reliable, which this Election Commission was not. So they need to get that thing fixed. And for example, in case of Bangladesh, there's a major problem is the campaign finance. How the money, who is providing the money, where the money is coming from. The common phrase is the black money. That means illegally gotten money, you know. So there should be something done in order to make sure that people who are, you know, using this money, they should be at least held accountable. So there are a few things we expect, at least I expect, that this government will do before they actually have an election. Hopefully not too long.
Well, our guest again this morning on this in this hour, Focus 580, is Professor Ali Rias. He is Associate Professor in the Department of Politics and Government at Illinois State University. We're talking about the politics of Bangladesh. We have a caller here. Welcome others. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Tried to make this intervention short here. I wanted to go back to the antecedents. The 71 attack on Bangladesh by Pakistan is called a bloody genocide by some observers, and I just want to know what the U.S. role was in that. I think we were backing Pakistan in a rather large way. And the 75 coup, bloody military coup, was also sort of done with more than a wink and a nod from the U.S. And I'm wondering if it fits in the whole pattern of anybody but the secular leftists or something, you know, that we would, this is a whole strain of discussion that's going on some places anyway, that the U.S. has always just backed anyone who's, who's quote-unquote anti-communist. I guess that's enough. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, going back to 1971, the role of the United States in 1971 was that the United States supported Pakistan. They didn't want that the Bangladesh should emerge as an independent country, largely because this whole crisis was seen through the Cold War prism, I would call. Henry Kissinger and other thought that supporting Pakistan is the best thing to do because Pakistan was the conduit for connection with China. At that point, the Pakistan was the go-between between China and the United States, and at that point, the China was necessary, at least from the U.S. point of view, in order to create some sort of an alliance so that they can confront the Soviet Union. So the whole thing, the 1971, the Bangladesh movement was opposed on practically, I would not say on the anti-communist plank, but mostly it was from the global Cold War point of view. You mentioned about 1975, and here Lawrence Lipsuge and others have tried in many ways to demonstrate the U.S. connection. There are circumstantial evidence at best to show that the United States was in some ways involved with the 1975 coup. We don't have hard evidence at that point. As of today, and my own work, say, for example, when I was doing my dissertation, it was about state, class, and military rule, basically looking into the political economy of martial law. I've tried to gather as much evidence to suggest there, as I said, you can see some, you know, not exactly conclusive evidence, but there are indications that the United States might have been involved in some ways. But then again, we don't have the evidence as much as we have in case of Chile. It fits the pattern. It fits the pattern because in 1975, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman was not exactly very liked by the U.S. administration. Henry Kissinger personally didn't like him. And the Bangladesh was seen at that point as something as not exactly an ally or friend of the United States, given the nationalist posture of Bangladesh government and the secular movement. So all in all, I mean, 1971 and 1975, the U.S. role was not exactly something that should that the United States should be proud of.
What was the character of the military coup? Were they also some kind of modernizing secularists, or is it not fair to say that they were sort of the first part of a compromise? As I mentioned, supporting an Islamicist faction over any kind of secular.
We are talking about 1975, right?
Yes, exactly.
1975 coup was modernizing, yes, but not necessarily secularist. I mean, but the way we see Islamists today, 1975, as you can understand, 30 plus years ago, it was not exactly similar. In 1975, as I was mentioning previously, the government that came in under the leadership of Zia Rahman, first of all, the 1975 coup, there were succession of coups. Basically, there was one on 15th August, then another on 3rd November, then another on 7th November. At the end of all this chaos and confusion, what we have seen is the rise of Zia Rahman as the strongman. And what happened is Zia Rahman, in the later days, by 1977, he actually rallied the not-so-secularist, if I may call them, and also introduced some of the Islamic rhetoric into Bangladesh politics. He changed the constitution. The secular nature of Bangladesh constitution was changed during the Zia-ur Rahman regime in 1977. So what we have seen is the 1975 coup, if you take those two words, modernizing and Islamist, yes, it has done some of the modernizing thing, but not necessarily it was a secularist one. Rather, it had created environment within which we have seen later the rise of the Islamist, you know, mostly. And BNP, the political party which grew out of that military coup, which believes that there is a role of religion in politics, in public life, and that is what they stand for.
Thank you.
Thank you. Right,
thanks for the call. Others, welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just to go back for a second, I don't want to belabor this point that we talked earlier about the rivalry between the two parties, the BNP and the Awami League, and their leaders. That part of the animosity between the two women who are leading the party is that apparently that Sheikh Hasina of the Awami League believes that the General Zia Rahman had something to do with the death of her. This is getting very confusing. Had something to do with the death of her father,
Sheikh Mujib.
Sheikh Mujib. True.
It lacks hard evidence. I mean, these sort of claims, I would say, you can say, he was the beneficiary, of course. That Ziaur Rahman was the beneficiary of the death of Sheikh Mujibur.
Because he became president.
He became later became the president. Yeah. So in that way, you can say that, yes, he might have been. But I haven't seen any conclusive evidence to that effect. As a matter of fact, when Awami League alleges those things, there was a trial of Mujib murder. And this political part was completely pushed aside. Mm. Who was behind? Those people who pulled the trigger, they were, you know, tried. But who were behind this? This is not that simply 6 or 7 or 10 or 15 people just went and killed Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, right? Mm-hmm. So there must have been something behind that. Who planned that? Who were the people, you know? The trial never went into or got into that part of the politics. So I would say Ziaur Rahman benefited, but whether he engineered, conspired, there are lack of hard evidence.
Yeah. We talked about the fact that there was this period between 91 and 2006 when the two main parties, no doubt in coalition with others, had the government. And that during the time that it seemed that during the time that the one party is in government, the other party basically doesn't want is non-cooperative, to say the least.
They made the parliament dysfunctional, practically. Between 1991 and 1996, when BNP was in power, Awami League, most of the days, would not show up in the parliament. They boycotted the parliament, you know. And then between 1996 and 2000, when Awami League was in power, BNP didn't show up, you know. They boycotted the parliament. And between 2001 and 2006, Awami League boycotted the parliament. So this is practically paying back in their own coins sort of situation. Mm-hmm. You know? And that is not very helpful. As a matter of fact, that is why I say that it is not only about two political leaders. It is about political culture.
So that just it makes it sound as if things would sort of settle down and there would be an election and one or the other party got the most votes, it sounds as if it almost doesn't matter. I mean, to them it matters, yes, but it sounds like as far as the country is concerned and the ability of government to govern, it sounds as if it almost doesn't matter.
In some ways, yes. You know, that's the painful part of it. The painful mm-hmm. part of it is that whoever is in the power, I mean, in terms of, forget about this, the parliament, in terms of corruption, mm-hmm. over the last 5 years, the proportion, the extent of corruption was huge and, you know, unprecedented. In some ways, it has, made other people's... I'm kind of really, I don't know how to put it, you know. It's huge, I mean. But if you go back between 1996 and 2001, there was corruption. And 1991-96 corruption. If you take the corruption, for example, you'll see that it is practically endemic in Bangladeshi society. And whoever is in the government, they use the government machineries in order to get the money, you know. So it doesn't matter who is in the power. You can pretty much be sure that someone is going to steal the money, you know.
Yeah. So then obviously there's a question about in the meantime, when all of this is happening in politics, what's happening in the country? And what does that mean for the daily life of people in Bangladesh and the possibility that there can be development, that lives of people can be improved, that you can deal with basic issues like need for education and poverty and public infrastructure. Does anything get done?
That is the interesting part of it, David. Bangladesh has achieved growth rate of 6% in last 15 years, consistently. Mm-hmm. 5.6, somewhere between 5 and 6. In most cases, it is 5.5. This is the resilience of Bangladeshi people. Bangladesh has almost met the Millennium Development Goal in terms of providing education to the girl child. And they're way ahead of other South Asian countries. If you look at the providing education, or if you look at the general quality of life, it has improved in the last 15 years. And that is why I say that Bangladesh is a paradox in some ways. It's, usually we say that, okay, without good governance, development is impossible, right? That is the general notion, common understanding. But look at Bangladesh. It has defied all sorts of things. Because in the last 15 years, yes, despite those democratic practices, what we have seen is that, it is not exactly something we should be proud of in many ways, you know, the way political parties behaved. But general people, common people, they have worked. And worked so much so that you see that Bangladesh, since 1974, Bangladesh never faced a food crisis. The last famine Bangladesh faced was in 1974. And population has almost doubled since 1974. They don't get a new inch of land somewhere else, right? Mm. Yet the food production has increased to that extent that they can feed these people. So Bangladesh is, and then again, if you look at its garment sector, if you look at the remittances sent by people, the millions of people who are suffering outside, all sorts of things, all sorts of indications are there that if political parties can actually provide a semblance of good governance, the situation will be far better. Within all these problems, Bangladeshis have achieved reasonably good and remarkably, good economic development. 6%, 5.6%. So things are getting done despite corruption, despite all these political unrest and everything. We see that Bangladeshis are working and Bangladeshis are doing what they are supposed to do. Mm. The common people are actually contributing to the growth of the economy.
Something I want to make sure that we talk about is the involvement of Islamist political parties in politics in Bangladesh, and the possibility that perhaps the kind of political unrest that we've talked about creates greater opportunities for Islamist parties, perhaps militant Islamist parties, to gain strength in the country. I think that some people are concerned about what that would mean in the future of the country. Is there a possibility that we would see an Islamic government come to power in that country?
Not in near term. Mm. There are a couple of things here when we talk about the Islamists. The first thing is that one of the largest, or the largest perhaps, largest Islamist political party, Jamaat-e-Islami, was a partner of the coalition which ruled Bangladesh from 2001 to 2006. Mm-hmm. Okay. In my understanding, they have infiltrated inside the administration everywhere. So this is one aspect of it. This political crisis that we have seen, if democracy fails in Bangladesh, the primary beneficiary would be the Islamist, because they will be able to demonstrate that, see, this democracy doesn't work. This kind of political system doesn't work. So we are the only one. We can save you from this kind of situation. That is why I'm worried about this political crisis. In some form or other, democracy must continue. Elections must continue, however flawed it is. We should try to fix this, but there should be regular elections. Because if you look at the regular elections, in the last three elections, the support for Islamists actually has reduced, declined remarkably. Jamaat-e-Islami secured 12% vote in 91, and in last election they secured only 4% vote. That is one part of the Islamist story, that there are these Islamists like Jamaat-e-Islami and Islamic Kojut who were the partner of the coalition government. There's another part is the militant groups, clandestine militant groups. They're small, but you don't need very many people to create a havoc, right? Mm. That is why all these political uncertainties are beneficial in the long run for these Islamist group. Politically, those who are on the open politics, who are participating, quote-unquote, in the democratic politics, because most of these, if you look at their political agenda, they're not exactly a democratic political party. But nevertheless, some of the Islamists are participating in the democratic politics. And on the other hand is the militant groups. So any anarchic situation, any uncertainty, any kind of absence of democracy, in any kind of political unrest is going to help them in the long run. But at this point, I don't see any Islamist government in Bangladesh soon. And here my point is soon. Mm-hmm. In long term, if situation the way it is going, we should not completely discount that one. There are other problems. There are other roadblocks, I would say. Civil society, the strength of the civil society in Bangladesh, non-governmental organization, women's movement in Bangladesh, very strong. All of them will be major roadblocks towards Islamist uprising or Islamist taking over the government. But then again, things change. Nothing is static.
Yeah. Well, I think that here a lot of people raise the example of Afghanistan and the rise of the Taliban, which some people apparently saw, at least initially, as being a kind of a stabilizing mm-hmm. force. Mm-hmm. And I suppose some people – now, I don't know if the comparison is appropriate, but some people would say, well, maybe – you know, if the kind of unrest continues, as you say, and if the present trends continue, that maybe we might get to a point sometime where we would see Bangladesh going that same way.
Islamists would love that one. That is what they want to see, actually, that if there is an anarchic situation. I would not say it would be like Afghanistan because, see, before Afghanistan, we never talked about Afghanistan model, right? Yeah. So yeah. This would be different. This could be different. And as I said, that is how the Islamists would benefit from this crisis. And that is what they want from this. That is why I think, however, this mainstream two main political parties feel, they should understand, and others, that they have a larger stake in the system.
We're coming down here. We have about 2 minutes, maybe 2-3 minutes. And one last thing that I'm interested in having you talk about is it possible here that outsiders, the United States or anybody else, could help by either offering whatever assistance they could or putting whatever pressure they could on, particularly on the two parties, but on whoever there within Bangladesh to say, look, for the long-term interest of the country, it would be important everybody work together for political stability and to try to cooperate, to see the election happen, to see if we can have a government that functions better, that all of that is in the long-term interest of the country and perhaps also of that region. Is there much possibility for outsiders to play a role like that?
Yes, I think the outsiders can, and actually the things that happened on January 11th, is largely because of the external pressure. I would not, if you want to take the word pressure out of it, at least external interest. I mean, they have been a participant in the process. They talk to the political parties, and finally, in some ways, when the United Nations told that they're not going to help the election process, and when the U.S. ambassador in Dhaka and the U.K. ambassador, high commissioner in Dhaka and others told that they're not going to accept a one-sided election. That is when military acted. So, yes, they can do something. But at the same time, this is a problem that Bangladeshis will have to sort out themselves. You know, it's their problem. You simply cannot solve the problem outside. It is not possible. They can help. International community has a role to play. And they have played that role to a great extent in January. I hope they will continue playing that role. But at the same time, it should be clearly told that to the Bangladeshis that it's their problem. They will have to solve it.
At the time in 1971, when in what was at that time East Pakistan, there was this this independence movement to break away from West Pakistan and become an independent country. The independence movement there, the Awami League, they were supported by India. Mm-hmm. And I would expect that was at least in part, as far as India was concerned, a way of sticking their finger in the eye of the Pakistanis. You know, obviously, you know, my enemy's enemy is my friend. It goes along in that principle. Although I would also imagine that because, after all, India borders on Bangladesh or East Pakistan, Bangladesh, so the Indians would obviously also be interested in what was going on there. Is there still an Indian interest here?
Indians, I mean, of course, the Indians have interest because it is their neighborhood. You know, India is the largest country in that region. India has regional interest. India did well in 1971, but today is not 1971. It is 2007. And India needs to act very pragmatically. And now Bangladesh is an independent country. And when we are talking about independent country, of course, they have their pride and the nationalistic pride and all sorts of things. Bangladesh is a small country, but definitely it has its own pride. And they would love to and should be allowed to keep their independence. So Indian interest is there, but how India behaves, whether they behave as you know, big brother, that's an issue, because India is a sensitive issue in Bangladesh politics, in domestic politics.
Well, we're going to have to finish up here. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you're interested in hearing more from our guest, Professor Ali Riaz, he's associate professor in the Department of Politics and Government at Illinois State University. He'll be giving a talk, Bangladesh in 2007, Saving Democracy from the Politicians. That is the title. It is jointly sponsored by the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security, and the Program in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. This afternoon, 3:30 on the U of I campus in room 356 of the Armory Building, and I'm sure anybody who was interested should feel welcome. Also, if you're interested in the politics in this region, you might look at the book that I mentioned at the beginning of the program. Its title is God Willing, The Politics of Islamism in Bangladesh by our guest, Professor Ali Riaz. Thanks very much for being
Thank
here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.